under me, and I almost tipped over and fell flat on my face. I managed to keep my balance, though, and looked down to see that where the birdbath had stood just a few seconds earlier, a small round door, like a manhole, had appeared in the ground. I leaned down and tentatively lifted it. Inside, a stairway spiraled into darkness. From somewhere high above my head, I heard a loud, "Caw-caw!" Then an excited rustling. I'd gotten their attention. Another crow cried out, and then another, and another, until they all seemed to be screaming at me. A rumbling sound began to build as my peripheral vision clouded with a fluttering blackness. The rumble got louder and louder, and then I realized what it was. It was the sound of hundreds of birds flapping their wings all at once. They were all flying right for me. With no time to worry about what was down there, I stepped through the door and plunged down the twisting stairway. I felt like I was running for my life, trusting my feet to find their purchase against the treacherous stone stairs. They didn't let me down. Knox had trained me well. The door slammed shut behind me, and everything suddenly went completely black. Able to see exactly nothing, I stopped and looked up and waited for my eyes to adjust. They didn't. I decided to light my knife up again, finding it even easier the second time than the first, and held it aloft. Or tried to. I hit rock a few inches above my head. I climbed back up the staircase and examined the back of the door, but it didn't have any handles or buttons. I had no idea how to open it back up. Well, I thought, at least it will keep the crows out. Plus, I might be trapped. With no other direction to go but down, and only my knife to light the way, I descended. When the steps finally ended, I looked around, the glow of my knife lighting up an entire room. The Scarecrow's House of Horrors was almost as I had imagined it to be, except worse. There were two long metal tables set up with horrific instruments like the ones I'd seen in his room, and a metal chair with restraints on the arms and the legs. I was pretty sure that's what Maud had been strapped into yesterday. So where was she now? Next to the chair was a square, squat machine with a bunch of circular dials and gauges on it. It was attached to a long leather tube. I didn't want to know what that was. Against the wall was a huge shelf lined with big glass jars, the kind that Gert kept her dried herbs and potion ingredients in. But these jars weren't filled with mandrake root and nightshade dust. Many of them held what looked like brains floating around in some kind of glowing green liquid. I stepped closer. They were pulsing. They were still alive, I realized in horror. It wasn't just brains. There were other body parts, too. Ears and hands and tiny little white wings. From baby monkeys? I shuddered. I turned my attention to a wooden drafting table, which was papered with sketches and anatomical diagrams. There were monkeys, kalidas, a chicken, and a few other animals I didn't even recognize. I tore my eyes away and began looking for signs of actual life. "Hello?" I called out. "Is anyone here? Maud?" I wasn't really expecting an answer, but then I heard a noise, a barely audible moan coming from behind a metal door I hadn't noticed in the back of the room, on the other side of the boxy machine. The moan came again, louder this time, and I knew that, as afraid as I was, there was someone or something on the other side who had it a lot worse than me. I held my breath before opening the door, picturing all the terrible things I might find. The next room was smaller and filled entirely with rusty metal gurneys. They were caked in dried blood, but at least there were no bodies on them. Then I saw her. In the back of the room, a tiny monkey in a frilly pink dress was cowering in a metal cage that was barely big enough to contain her. Feathers from her twisted, mangled wings poked through the bars. "Maud," I asked gently, "is that you?" She looked up at me with scared, big brown eyes. They looked like Ollie's, only minus the mischief. But the rest of her was not at all like Ollie. Her head was freshly shaved, and her arms were wrapped with cloth bandages. I crouched down next to her. "I'm here to get you out," I said in the gentlest voice possible.
"Who?"
she croaked wearily. "I'm Amy. Ollie sent me."
"Ollie?"
Her eyes filled with momentary hope before clouding over again.
"No," she said. "He would never. Why would he help me when I was so terrible to him?"
"Why wouldn't he?" I asked.
"He was right about everything. I should have listened."
Her eyes rolled back into her head. "Maud," I said, snapping my fingers in her face, "can you move? We need to get you out of here." She nodded, but otherwise she didn't budge. She was out of it. I'm pretty sure she thought I was a dream. I started looking around for the keys to her cage, then realized I didn't need them. The scarecrow would know Maud had escaped, so screw it. I bashed the lock with my dagger until it broke open. The banging seemed to wake Maud up a bit, and her eyes focused on me. I leaned in and helped her out of her prison and onto the ground. But when I tried to lift her into my arms to carry her, she brushed my hands away.
"I can walk," Maud said.
As an afterthought, she reached over her shoulder and felt for her wings, like she had forgotten whether or not she still had them. As she brushed her fingers through the matted feathers, I couldn't tell if she was relieved or disappointed. She didn't say anything. She just reached up and grabbed my hand and hobbled along beside me, past the gurneys, and through the door into the main lab. I could hear the crows outside, their mad caws echoing down the passageway. We weren't going to be able to leave that way. "Is there another way out of here?" I asked. Maud either didn't hear my question or chose to ignore it. Her eyes had filled with rage. She was staring at the scarecrow's machine. "Did he use that on you?" I asked, my voice somber. Slowly, she nodded. "Hell with it. Why stop wrecking stuff now?" I walked to the machine and shoved it over. It crashed loudly to the ground, its gears spilling out and spiraling across the floor like loose change. I looked back at Maud.
"He'll only fix it," she said.
"I know," I replied, "but I'd love to see the look on his stupid straw face when he finds it." Her cracked lips twitched, not quite smiling, but I thought I saw a spark of happiness in her tired eyes. "What did he do to you?" I asked. "What is the scarecrow building down here?"
I don't remember."
She put a hand up to her shaved head, her eyes squeezed shut in pain. I couldn't tell if it was physical or mental. Did it hurt to think, or did it hurt to remember what had been done to her?
"He drained me."
Maud knuckled the back of her head.
"He's trying to make himself smarter."
I thought of Ozma and wondered if maybe the scarecrow had drained her brain, too. "But why?" I asked, looking around at all the equipment. the wall of specimens. It had to be something more than the scarecrow having brain envy. Nothing went on in this palace that didn't somehow benefit Dorothy.
He's going to...
She drifted off, going hazy. And then, suddenly, the birds went silent.
What has gotten into you? Be quiet, you dreadful beasts,
I heard the scarecrow shouting at the ravens. He was back. The fire must have been put out. We were out of time.
Oh, no,
Maud moaned. Her knees went weak, and I felt her almost collapse next to me. I grabbed her by the shoulders. Tell me there's another way out of here. She shook her head, her eyes drifting toward the staircase.
Only through there.
Trapped. My only option was magic. Take my hand, I told Maud, trying to sound confident. I'm getting us out of here. I had never gotten that comfortable with the travel spell that Mombi had taught me, but at this point, I had to risk it. It was dangerous. Gert and Nox had told me time and time again that I should never travel without clearly visualizing my destination. Otherwise, I was liable to end up teleporting myself into the middle of a brick wall. I closed my eyes and tried to picture the royal gardens. I'd never actually been out there, only glimpsed them that day when I saw the lion pop the eye out from that guard. What did I remember? The sunflowers. A sprawling bed of overgrown sunflowers where the lion had been napping. I pictured the flowers, but it wouldn't do to travel into them, not unless I wanted petals and stems sticking out of me. I imagined the space directly above the flowers, the cool night air, the moonlight, the royal gardens. I focused on the details that would be below me, imagining the empty space where we'd travel. It would be the most powerful spell I'd ever cast, and the most important. My dagger throbbed in my hand. It wanted to stay and fight. Not a sound strategy, but that's the kind of instinctual advice you get from a magic object that's primary purpose is stabbing. Distantly, I heard the scarecrow shuffling down the steps. He was close, but I was already imagining myself far away. Hold on to me, I whispered. Even my own voice sounded as if it came from down a tunnel, the magic building up within me. I felt Maud squeeze my hand, and then I let go. Not of her, but of this place. I heard a whooshing in my ears, felt the magic pulling me apart, and then we were gone. Chapter 35. Maud and I materialized right above the sunflowers, just like I pictured, and tumbled in a heap through the petals and leaves, stems cracking beneath us. The ground was soft, the landing not too rough. We'd made it. We were alive. I'd completed a travel spell, the most complicated magic I'd ever done, and it worked. I felt laughter bubbling up within me. You okay? I asked Maud, my throat suddenly dry, like I'd been dehydrated. Yes, she croaked back, and we began crawling our way out of the flowers. I was exhausted. The spell had worked, yeah, but all my appendages had that pins and needles feeling, and I had the vague sense that I'd left part of myself behind, like the magic had taken a price. Also, considering how powerful the spell was, I worried that Dorothy might have felt it or detected it somehow. There was nothing I could do about that now. Ollie was waiting for us. All I could see of him were his eyes. They were unblinking and glowing yellow, shining down at me.
You fell out of the sky,
he said to me, baffled. I waved at him weakly. No big deal. As I struggled back to my feet, Ollie locked eyes with Maud. I don't know if I'd been expecting them to hug or what. The last time they'd seen each other, she'd spit on him, so maybe that was pushing it. But they didn't. It was awkward, neither one of them sure what to say, until Maud finally broke the silence. You came back for me, she said softly. After everything. Ollie cut her off with an embrace. He held her tight, and Maud squeezed back, although I noticed her fingers brushing over the stubs where his wings used to be. I let them have a moment, looking toward the palace. The royal gardens were on the other end of the grounds, away from the greenhouse and the scarecrow's burned bedroom. The windows on this side were dark, empty. There weren't any patrols around, but I didn't want to take any chances. Sorry, guys, I interrupted, but you need to get moving. Both monkeys turned to me. Maud bit down on her lip, looking suddenly nervous about something. There's just one more thing, Ollie said, glancing surreptitiously at my dagger. My shoulders slumped. I was already exhausted from the night's events. I didn't know how much more I could do. What is it? You need to cut off my wings, Maud replied. I stared at her. What? The wings are tied to Dorothy's magic, Ollie explained somberly. As long as I still have them, she has power over me, Maud finished. I noticed her flexing her wings as she spoke, as if trying to commit the feeling to memory. I won't be able to leave the palace grounds with them. Ollie had already unclipped a pouch from his belt, opening it up to reveal sutures and some clean rags. I glared at him. You knew we'd have to do this. Ollie nodded. Yes, sorry I didn't tell you, but you volunteered. I flipped the dagger around in my hand, gently clutching the still warm blade, and held it out to him. You do it, I said. Ollie looked from me to the blade, then at Maud. I could see him trying to steel himself, to find the courage to accept my challenge. After a moment, he looked away. I can't, he said quietly. She was his sister. Of course he couldn't mutilate her. That job fell to me. Maud grabbed my hand. Please, she said quietly. My stomach clenched. You've already opened my cage. Now set me really free. Cutting them away was the easy part. My knife was sharp and hot. The worst part, the part I worried would stick with me, was the sound they made, and how the wings began to flutter on their own. Blood poured down my hands, so dark it was almost black. The heat of my blade cauterized the wound some. Ollie huddled beside me, staunching the blood and suturing where needed. I am so sorry. I am so sorry, I kept repeating. I don't think she heard me. I didn't know a spell to numb the pain, or I would have used it. Maud bore it without a scream or even a whimper, knowing that we needed to keep quiet. Softly, almost under her breath, she hummed a strange, sad song. It sounded like a children's song. Our parents used to sing that to us, Ollie whispered. A nursery rhyme about learning to fly. I don't even remember the words. Maud wasn't crying, so I held my tears back too. The least I could do was be as brave as she was. When the first wing fell to the ground, Maud lost consciousness. I checked her breath just to make sure she was still alive, but I didn't try to rouse her. Ollie cleaned and bandaged the first stump while I moved on to the other. This one took longer, my arms heavy and weak. When it was done, Ollie lifted her into his arms, cradling her like a baby. She stirred, looking at me blearily.
"Thank you,"
she murmured. I nodded and opened my mouth to say something. Instead, I found myself collapsing onto my knees. Ollie leaned close, his face now level with mine.
"Come with us,"
he said urgently, and jerked his chin in the direction of the stone wall that separated the royal gardens from the Emerald City.
"I can bring you to the dark jungle and the other wingless ones."
I trusted the monkeys, but even though I still hadn't heard from the Order, I knew I had to see this thing through. I shook my head. "No," I replied, gritting my teeth and trying to pull it together. "My mission is here." In the darkness, I couldn't tell whether the look on Ollie's face was admiration or pity.
"In that case, Amy of Kansas," he said, "you need to stand up."
I struggled to my feet, every muscle sore and aching. I felt like I might crumble back to the ground at any second. When I was finally up, Ollie shifted Maud into one arm and held out his other hand to me. I reached out to grip it, thinking that he was just saying goodbye, but he pressed something metal into my palm. When I looked down, I saw that it was a tiny silver arrow, no bigger than the needle on an ordinary compass.
"It will lead you to the wingless ones," Ollie said. "Keep it safe. Keep it with you. Use it to find us when you need us most."
I blinked at him, shocked. He had made no secret of how the wingless ones wanted nothing to do with the wicked. He knew I was loyal to them, and he was trusting me with this anyway.
"We work for no one," Ollie said, as if he sensed my surprise. "But you have proven yourself. You are our friend, and we will help you however we can."
"Thank you," was all I managed to say. The words were barely out of my mouth, and he was already on the move, carrying Maud toward the shadows of the wall. Once there, he didn't climb over. Instead, he lifted up a flap of grass and disappeared beneath it. A tunnel, I realized. The wingless ones had dug a tunnel. The silver arrow twitched in my fist in the direction of the wall. I now knew there was a way out, but I couldn't yet take it. I was lucky to make it back to my room, so weak I was practically crawling the whole way without drawing any attention. At one point, I had to duck behind a curtain to avoid being spotted by a pair of palace guards. They were chatting about the freak accident in the Scarecrow's room. Good. I hoped that nobody suspected foul play. Well, at least until the Scarecrow discovered Maud missing and flipped out. All I wanted to do was collapse into bed and sleep for a million years. But I couldn't until I got myself cleaned up. As I washed the blood from my hands in the little basin by the cupboard, the sounds of bones cracking and feathers flapping echoed in my head. When I closed my eyes, all I saw were Maud's twisted, injured wings falling into the grass. I shuddered. Doing good had been uglier than I'd expected it to be. And the price? The price now was feeling like I needed to always be looking over my shoulder. Maybe I'd taken too many risks. And now,
to get rid of the evidence. I needed to take one more. I felt dizzy, like I was spinning out of control. But I shoved it down, doing what needed to be done. I pulled off my blood-crusted dress and placed it carefully on my bed. Waving my finger at it, I lit it with a magical flame. It burned quickly and noiselessly, its fabric blackening and smoking, hissing and popping. At least no one in the palace would find the smell of smoke out of place. Though the fire danced across my sheets and mattress, the spell did its job. They remained unharmed by the flames. I stood there, practically naked, just watching, my arms crossed across my chest, until the evidence was finally disposed of. There wasn't even a trace of ash left behind. It was as if it had never happened. The room wasn't even hot. But I could still see the fire burning on my retinas when I closed my eyes. Much smaller than the one I'd set outside the Scarecrow's chambers, but with more magic. I felt weakened, an emptiness in my core like a hunger. If Dorothy had detected my use of magic, I'd be in trouble. I needed some support. I needed someone to tell me what I'd done hadn't been a total waste. What was one free monkey in the scheme of things? A minor victory, at what cost? Where was the order? Why had they left me all on my own? I turned to the mirror that I'd come somersaulting out of almost a week ago. "Nox," I said. My voice came out angrier than I meant it to. "Nox, I don't know if you can see me. I don't know if you're listening. But I need you." There was no answer. Chapter 36. The hunt was already on when I woke up. From the tiny window in my room, I watched the monkeys circling the grounds. There were dozens of them in the air, swooping and diving. I couldn't help realize that even though winged monkeys are controlled by magic, today they were tethered to long metal chains that fastened in thick collars at their necks and were being held from the ground by the tin soldiers, who just stood there looking up at their prisoners like they were flying kites at the beach. I guess with one runaway monkey, they didn't want to take any chances that their magical power over the monkeys might be slipping. They were searching for her. I dressed slowly, feeling achy all over, and took an extra second to look at myself in the mirror. I half hoped that maybe Nox would appear there, but he didn't. I kissed Star on the nose and tucked her away safely in her drawer. I think she was getting used to it, or at least had stopped trying to scratch her way out of it. As I exited my room, I tried to inject a little extra pep in my step to make up for the worn-out feeling in my bones. Maybe I could borrow some of Jelaya's perma-smile. That reminded me. I had to get her keys back to her. I'd find a way to do it at breakfast. My stomach growled. Apparently, starting a fire, overusing magic, and chopping the wings off a monkey made a girl extremely hungry. Except, there was no breakfast. Instead, the maid staff was lined up from one end of the hall to the other. No food in sight. "What's going on?" I asked Syndra, the maid next to me, as I joined the line. "Surprise uniform inspection," she replied. Syndra blinked her extra-long eyelashes and shrugged. She didn't seem to have any clue that anything was up. Part of me envied her ignorance. Jelaya marched up and down the line, making sure everyone was in order for the inspection. Her scent was vastly improved. Dorothy must have finally let her take the mouse out of her pocket. She looked sharper than she had in days, but not quite chipper. Jelaya knew something was up, and it made her nervous. When she passed me, I saw the tiniest look of alarm flit across her eyes. Her mouth, probably slathered with perma-smile, didn't move. My pulse raced as I tried to stay calm. Had I missed something? Did I have one of Maud's feathers stuck in my hair? Jelaya stepped toward me. She licked her thumb and brusquely rubbed a spot behind my ear, a spot I couldn't have seen in my mirror. Astrid, she spoke quietly, without venom.
You've been slipping in your appearance lately. You're really going to have to learn to be tidier.
When she got close, I took the opportunity to slip Jelaya's keys back in her pocket. Her eyebrow arched at me. Maybe she felt the tug against her smock, but she didn't say anything more, just studied my face for a moment longer to make sure I was clean. I breathed a sigh of relief as she turned her back on me and continued her march down the line. The clomping shuffle of metal against marble approached, and then I knew for sure that this was no ordinary uniform inspection. Jelaya stepped back and faced us. I felt the other girls tensing up at my side as they began to realize it wouldn't be Jelaya conducting the inspection. Jelaya cleared her throat.
Ladies, the Tin Woodman and his men are going to ask you some questions. Be honest and concise. As long as you tell the truth, no harm will come to you.
I'd known this might happen, but I hadn't expected it so quickly. I thought I'd have some time to prepare my story. I steeled myself, willing my heart to slow, willing my face to stay smiling and placid as the Tin Woodman came lurching into the room, all business. Jelaya curtsied as he approached. The Tin Woodman didn't acknowledge the gesture. The Tin Woodman made quick work of the line, showing each of us a small picture of Maud and asking each of us about her whereabouts last night.
"Well, I don't know if I recognize the funny little creature," Syndra said, her turn right before mine. "It's a monkey. They all look the same to me."
I wanted to reach over and slap her. Of course, I didn't. I didn't even turn my head. A moment later, the Tin Woodman shoved the picture in my face, and I realized that I didn't have to lie about whether I recognized her. The drawing of Maud was nothing like the Maud I'd rescued the night before. Her fur was neatly combed, and her wings were folded behind her back. She had a pink bow in her hair and was wearing a little pair of green glasses. The little half-smile on her face was knowing and shy at the same time. I looked up at the Tin Woodman. I studied the seams that held his metal face together.
"I've never seen her," I lied confidently, then tried to copy some of Syndra's stupidity. "I don't have any contact with the monkeys. They have lice."
I remembered what I'd seen of the Tin Woodman in the magic picture in Dorothy's parlor, mooning over the princess. I knew his weakness. It should have been like picturing him in his metal underwear, thinking about him writing bad love poetry to Dorothy in motor oil. At that moment, it didn't make me feel much better. He lingered in front of me, taking longer than he had with the other girls.
"The last time this monkey was seen, she no longer had her fur," the Tin Woodman said, "or her wings. Use your imagination."
I didn't have to imagine. The image would never leave me.
"No fur or wings?" I asked, trying to conceal a wince at the horrible memory. "Shouldn't she be dead?"
The Tin Woodman's eyes flickered.
"She will be."
He stepped away from me then, holding up the picture for everyone to take a second look.
"This monkey escaped from the Scarecrow's lab late last night," he said. "She was gravely injured. She could not have escaped without help from someone inside the palace."
No one said anything. Abruptly, the Tin Woodman changed gears, his voice coldly demanding.
"Who is responsible for delivering hay to the Scarecrow's chambers? Step forward."
Everyone in the line hesitated, but one by one, four of us stepped forward, including me and Syndra. The Tin Woodman stared right at me, though. He stepped close again.
"You smell like smoke," he said dispassionately.
Could he even smell with that metal face? Was this a ploy? I blinked up at him innocently.
"My room was close to the fire, sir," I replied.
"Tell me your name, little maid."
"Astrid," I said, feeling less secure in my disguise spell than I had in days.
"Where are you from?"
"Gilliken Country," I said. Before he could ask any more questions, Jelaya cleared her throat loudly behind him.
"Your Greatness," she said, addressing the Tin Woodman, "we have duties to attend to, and we're already off to a late start. Dorothy will be very disappointed if we don't..."
The Tin Woodman gave me a last look, a long one.
"Maids, so good at getting every single detail right," he mused.
He stepped away from me, addressing the rest of the line.
"If any of you have information on our escaped monkey, you know where to find me. And don't put the hay near the lanterns, you little fools."
Metal hands clasped behind his back, the Tin Woodman strode from the room.
"Off to your duties, girls," Jelaya sing-songed when he was gone. "Don't dilly-dally. There's more work to be done than ever."
I was turning to follow Syndra when I felt a hand on my shoulder. It was Jelaya.
"Come with me," she said. "I have a special task that you can help me with."
That was unusual. My chest tightened, paranoia fluttering through me. Did Jelaya know? Had she figured out that I swiped her keys? That I used them to help Maud escape? I studied her face, but it was as placid and cheerful as ever. I didn't have any choice except to go with her. As she led me out of the dining hall, I felt my knife whispering for me to call it. But I didn't. Not yet. I wasn't entirely sure what Jelaya was up to, but I didn't totally distrust her. I would only have one chance to run. I had to make sure I took the right one.
"Of course this has to happen just so close to the ball," Jelaya chattered airily as we walked. "The Tin Woodman and his men are ripping apart every room, turning over every cushion. They don't care that we'll have to clean it all up before Dorothy's guests arrive, and Her Highness will not be pleased if even the slightest thing is out of place. Not to mention that mess in the Scarecrow's room."
It was the closest she'd ever come to complaining about anything. I followed along and listened, wondering what she was getting at.
"You know," she continued, "I've worked in the palace for a long time. I was here before the wizard, even. I was here during the Scarecrow's rule. I was here when Ozma was still herself. I was here when Dorothy returned."
"That is a long time," I said, trying to sound noncommittal. But I was curious just the same, and not only about why she could appear to be a young girl after so many years working in the palace. I wondered why she was telling me all this. She had never opened up around me before. Maybe that hug yesterday really had made a difference. Maybe she just wanted to talk. "Oz has been through many changes," she went on. "Oh, people talk about the real Oz, but I don't even know what they mean by that. Oz has rarely stayed the same for long. That's the magic, of course. Always changing." We were climbing the stairs now. Jelaya's smile was different from her usual phony mannequin grin. It was sad and far away. "I have some fairy blood, too, you know," she said. By now, I wasn't even sure if she was talking to me or talking to herself. "Not anywhere near as much as Ozma, of course. Not enough to make much of a difference. But enough to know that things could have been different." Finally, we were at my room. I looked over at Jelaya questioningly. Why had she brought me here? "I want you to be sure that your room is tidy," she explained. There was no hint in her voice that anything was out of the ordinary. "They'll be searching all of them, of course, and I know that you can be sloppy from time to time. I wouldn't want them to find it out of order. It would reflect badly on me." She stared at me meaningfully. This was a warning. I don't know how much Jelaya knew, but she'd brought me here, taken me away from my chores so that I could make sure everything was in order, so that I wouldn't get busted. "Jelaya, I..." She held up her hand.
"I'll expect you in the kitchen for dishes shortly."
Without another word, she walked away. But when I opened the door and stepped inside, I realized I was too late. Everything was out of place. The sheets had been stripped, the mattress had been cut down the center, feathers spilling everywhere. When I saw the open drawers overturned on the floor, I felt like I was going to throw up. Star was gone. Chapter 37. Outside the window, the sky turned from blue to purple to black. Even though it was barely after breakfast, Dorothy had turned the clock. I couldn't bring myself to care. Star was gone. My room had been ransacked. I was sure they knew about me, about who I really was. The Tin Woodman already seemed suspicious of me. They'd put it all together. I had to get out of here. I turned to face the mirror, which was basically the only thing in the room that had been left undisturbed. Could it be the way out, too? I ran my fingers over the smooth, reflective surface, hoping some kind of answer would reveal itself. "Knox," I said, knowing in my heart that it was useless. "Please help me. Tell me what to do. I need you." I thought I saw my image ripple, just barely, like when you drop a penny in a pool, and a quick surge of hope rushed through me. But the mirror remained unchanged. Any movement I'd seen had just been my imagination. I looked at my face, the face that wasn't really my own, and tried to remember what I really looked like. For some reason, it made me wonder what my mother was doing. I wondered how much time had passed since I'd left. I knew that time didn't work the same here as it did back home. Was she an old woman now? Had she found a new life without me? Or maybe 100 years had passed back in Kansas and she was now long dead. I shivered. Suddenly, I found myself longing for my real face. I thought about taking out the knife and cutting myself to reverse the spell, just to get a glimpse of the girl I had been. If I was going to be captured, or have to fight my way out, I decided I would do it as Amy. The blade came to me eagerly. It glinted in the mirror. I was just about to slice my palm open when I heard something behind me. First a rustle, then a squeak. I spun around to see Star emerging from a crevice between the floorboards and the wall, a tiny little space I had never noticed before.
"Star!" I cried. "Where the hell were you? Where did you come from?"
I was so overjoyed to see her that I didn't even care that I was talking to a rat that had no way of answering any of my questions. She must have escaped somehow. That's one good thing you can say about rodents. They know how to make a quick getaway. I just hoped she'd done it before they'd searched my dresser. Somehow I didn't think Dorothy would take kindly to a maid harboring a rat in her room. I knelt down to pick her up, but she darted away from me.
"Star?"
I stood back up and watched her closely. Something was up. She was frantically running around in a circle like she was trying to get my attention.
"What are you trying to tell me?" I asked.
As if she understood what I was asking, she scurried over to the door and began scratching at it. She wanted me to follow.
"Are you serious? Now?"
It was a bad idea. Worse than bad. Colossally bad. The Tin Woodman was tearing the rooms apart one by one. The whole palace was in chaos over the missing monkey, and I wasn't sure whether or not I was a suspect. Plus, Jelaya had already covered for me once this morning, and I still wasn't sure exactly what that was all about. The safest course of action for now was to keep my head down and be ready to run. Or ready to fight.
"Star," I said.
She squeaked. She'd never behaved like this before. It was a far cry from her lethargic, dusty acres days, usually spent napping in her exercise ball. Maybe there was some natural phenomena in Oz that made animals smarter. I mean, the monkeys talk, after all. I sighed. They do say rats are extremely intelligent. If she wanted me to follow, I would follow. As soon as I opened the door, Star raced out without hesitation. I chased after her. I guess if anyone caught me, I could tell them I was trying to strangle the rat on Dorothy's behalf. I was nervous, still unsure what exactly was going on. But Star wasn't. Star moved quickly and hugged the side of the hall as if she knew that she was supposed to be inconspicuous. As if she knew exactly where she was going, exactly what she was doing. After a couple of turns, past rooms where other maids were too busy diligently cleaning to notice us, Star came to an unexpected stop, right in front of a life-size statue of Dorothy. I'd probably dusted this a few times. There were others like it scattered all over the palace. In this one, Dorothy peered hopefully toward the horizon, the wall, while clutching a picnic basket, Toto's scruffy head poking out of it. This version of Dorothy reminded me of the sweet, innocent one I was familiar with, the way most people back home thought of her, sweet and smiling, her hair pulled into two plaits. Too bad she was fictional. I looked at the statue. I looked down at Star. She was twitching in expectation.
"Okay," I said, keeping my voice low.
"Now what?" Star rolled over onto her back, then back to her feet, and looked up at me. I didn't understand rat sign language, but I knew she was trying to show me something. I looked at the statue again. I thought about all those movies where a statue conceals a hidden door and almost laughed, looking down at Star.
Is this when I, like, lean on the statue and fall through a trap door?
I poked Stone Dorothy in the eye for emphasis, and nothing happened. In response, Star started running around in a circle, chasing her tail.
Star, I don't have time for this, I said. Things are already screwed up, and why am I talking to you? You're a rat.
Star stopped chasing her tail and looked at me, lifting one of her front legs off the ground. It was like she wanted to shake hands. Rolling over, chasing her tail, shaking hands. These were dog tricks. I looked back at the statue. Toto's front paw was sticking out of the basket. I looked dubiously back at Star, who squeaked. Feeling a little dumb for humoring my pet rat, I shook Toto's paw. It moved under my hand like a lever. Something inside the statue clicked, and then an almost imperceptible ripple went through the marble, like the shimmer of heat coming off a sidewalk in the summer. Star squeaked and raced up to the statue's base, running right through it, almost like the statue was a hologram. Tentatively, I reached out and touched what seconds ago had been cold, solid marble. Although it looked no different to the naked eye, now my hand passed right through it. I glanced down the hallway in either direction. The coast was still clear. Well, I'd followed Star this far. I took a deep breath, fighting back the instinct that said I was about to smash my face against a rock, and walked through Dorothy's statue. I found myself on a stone staircase lit by glowing, shimmering orbs of energy that lined the cracked ancient walls. I glanced over my shoulder, and for a moment I could see the back of the Dorothy statue, but then it faded into solid rock. In front of me was a staircase that led nowhere but down. Great. I heard Star chittering up ahead, so I pressed on. The ceiling above the staircase was so low and cramped that I had to duck my head to walk down it. Probably built for munchkins, I thought. I caught up with Star at the bottom. The ceiling opened up down there, the same orbs from the staircase illuminating an ancient chamber with a dirt floor. Dust tickled my nostrils. It didn't seem like anyone had been down here for a long time. I wondered if this was like one of the tunnels Ollie and Maud had disappeared into last night. What did you get me into? I muttered to Star. We followed the tunnel, the only sounds my soft footfalls and Star's clicking nails. I glanced over my shoulder once and watched as my footprints quickly filled back in, like some invisible force was making sure to erase all trace of my passing. I started walking a lot faster after that. I had the constant sense that something might start chasing me at any moment. After only a few minutes, the tunnel came to an abrupt dead end. I looked back again and couldn't see the staircase we'd come from, even though it didn't seem like we'd gone that far. Instead, the tunnel stretched on forever behind me. Something told me there was no going back. A ladder was built into the wall in front of me. It was wooden and rickety, and led up through a narrow hole in the ceiling. I tested it, rattling it hesitantly to be sure it would support my weight. It shook, but it didn't give way. So I put Star in my pocket and began to climb, not knowing where it would lead me. It was a tight squeeze. Like the staircase, this tunnel was basically munchkin size. I'd never been claustrophobic before, but I was still supremely relieved to see a square of light overhead. At the top of the ladder, I reached up and lifted a square door. I opened it slowly, peeking out, not sure where I'd be popping up. From above, dirt shook loose into my face. It was a flap carved into the grass, just like the one Ollie had used the night before. Except this one appeared to lead into a bunch of shrubs. Well, at least no one would be able to see me emerging from the earth. I crawled and clawed my way up and out, through leaves and thorns and branches. When I was finally able to stand, I looked around, pulled a bunch of leaves from my hair, dusted myself off, and found that I was in the palace's sculpture garden, a place I'd seen in the distance, out the window, but had never been in before. It wasn't that far from the greenhouse, and I was a little nervous to be in the proximity of the Scarecrow's lab again so soon, but no one was around. The search for Maud must have gone to the other side of the palace, to the royal gardens, where they'd probably discovered her mutilated wings by now. The sculpture garden had always looked green and peaceful from a distance. Up close, it was nothing like that at all. Giant topiaries trimmed into the figures of Oz luminaries, the lion, the Tin Woodman, and the Scarecrow and Glinda, as well as others that I didn't recognize, all towered over my head, all of them dark and shadowy in the moonlight as they stared creepily down at me. Life-size stone statues were mixed in among them. They were made from a flaky, brittle shale, all of them with eyes that seemed strangely lifelike, as if they were watching me sneak through their ranks. I pushed down the sudden desire to draw my dagger. The statues were carefully arranged along a spiraling stone path through the hedges. They appeared to represent every race and creature in Oz. Humans, munchkins, quadlings, and also stranger humanoids like an armless brute with a hammer-shaped head, and a gang of sprite-sized people with horns sticking out of their foreheads. As I moved quickly down the path, Star wriggled in my pocket. I reached down for her, but she squirmed free of my hand and jumped onto the stone path. She darted on ahead. This wild goose chase wasn't over. This time, I didn't question it. Clearly, she had a destination in mind. So I followed her as she scurried along, trying not to look at the gruesome faces of the statues staring at me until we reached the entrance to the hedge maze. There, I stopped short. This was one place I didn't want to go. While the sculpture garden had always looked like a peaceful retreat from the vantage point of the palace windows, the hedge maze, on the other hand, even from a distance, had always given me the creeps. I don't know why. Maybe it was just the way it exuded magic, the way it seemed to change and rearrange itself every time you looked away from it. Even in the dark, the leaves of the hedges were technicolor green, so saturated that the color almost bled into the atmosphere. It seemed like the kind of place you could get lost in, the kind of place you could enter and never leave. Unfortunately, Star didn't seem to share my fear. She was already several yards ahead of me, and if I didn't hurry, she would be out of sight before I knew it. "Slow down," I hissed after her, but she didn't listen. I took a deep breath and followed her into the maze. As soon as I stepped inside, the leafy walls on either side of me began to rustle, suddenly sprouting little pink buds. The climbing ivy grew and twisted. My heart pounding, I looked back. The opening I'd just run through was no longer there. It had sealed up behind me with new growth.
Damn, I swore under my breath. I'd almost expected those frozen statues to come to life, but I hadn't expected the maze to.